And our special guest tonight, Nassim Haramain, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Now, it is called the Renaissance Resonance Project.org, the Resonance Project.org, which is linked right now to coasttocoastam.com. Nassim, if you had a group of kids in school and adults, they were all thrown into the same mix, how would you explain the Big Bang to them?
Well, you know, it's been interesting to teach kids because, you know, I love to do it. I teach my theories to kids all the time, and I really enjoy it because they have such an open mind and a great imagination, yeah. And they can visualize so well. But, you know, I think in general I would tell them that the Big Bang is most likely one of the bang that produce creation, that creation is constantly banging, that it's constantly being created in a continuous flow. You know, I'd probably explain the standard model before that, which is not the same. The standard model assumed only one bang. But certainly, you know, I try to convey to them that creation is occurring constantly, that you know, that there's a constant reorganization of the system that we live in, that it's constantly, you know, undoing itself and redoing itself and undoing itself and redoing itself. And actually, it was a... was discussing this with my four-year-old the other day, and after a few minutes of contemplation, he turned around and said, "You know, Papa, I think I can see it flickering in and out."
He might be right.
He might, you know, and I think that, like, it's like I was saying, it's this constant update of information that occurs in the universe that feeds back onto itself and reorganize the system to continuously, or, you know, create higher and higher levels of complexity and higher levels of organization. And we see it in nature everywhere, and we're actually evidence of it ourselves.
What if there was a massive-sized object, Nassim, in the universe, and that is what blew up, and that is what all the planets might be, and all the stars, mm-hmm. remnants of this huge object, maybe this only object that was in our universe, that simply blew up.
Right. Well, you know, that's very close to the standard view of the Big Bang. Other than the standard view starts with a very, very small object, an object the size of a singularity, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, very, very small, billions of times smaller than an atom.
The human brain can't even comprehend that, can it?
Yes, and, you know, and there's evidence for it. And actually, you know, what I'm saying in my theory is that every atom is one of those. It's one of those little teeny singularities. But if you started with a large object, you'd have to ask yourself, where did the matter come from to produce that object in the first place?
True.
And,
true.
You know, so what I'm saying is that...
But even a small particle, I'd ask the same question.
Exactly. Where did it come from? How come it blew up? Where did the energy come from to produce all the matter mm-hmm. that came out of it? And all these questions are typically avoided by our current standard theories. You know, we have very little understanding of what mass is. We have very little understanding of what magnetic fields are, electric fields, and so on. Most people think that most of these questions have been answered by advanced physics, but actually they remain great mysteries.
They're huge mysteries.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, not to put down folks who are physicists by any means, but I'm not sure if you had 10 physicists in a room, you'd come up with the same theory. You might come up with 10 different theories.
Absolutely. Actually, that's one of the major issues in physics, that there's not necessarily a consensus on the views of the appropriate physics. Certainly, there's a standard view, and that's the view that's taught in universities by college professors and so on. But, you know... there is as well, you see, the new physics that are being written is the physics that are being written by physicists that are not necessarily completely sold to the standard view. And they are, you know, they're the kind that are thinking about new ideas, new ways of looking at things, and come up with various ways of describing something. And it's a little bit like, you know, the story of the elephant with the blind man, you know, like four blind men looking at an elephant, and one's got the tail, and one's got the leg, and one's got the trunk, and they start to disagree on what the elephant looks like because they're experiencing different parts of it. And I think the crux here is to actually find a unified theory, a theory that unifies all these different views. And that's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, Einstein spent most of his life working on it. And this I think that if this occur, and I believe we're very close to it, I believe actually that the work I've done with the Schwarzschild proton with the black hole atom is a very powerful step in that direction, that there's a possibility that when we understand these fundamental dynamics of physics, the change in our society will be tremendous. From, you know, philosophical change and social change, but as well very advanced technological changes.
Absolutely. Now, you've talked about what is called the power of spin. Explain that. What does that mean?
Well, you know, that's another thing that in general in physics is not well explained, is the spin component of our universe. For instance, if you ask, what's spinning the Earth? Well, you'll be told that it's conserved energy from the spin of our solar system because the sun is spinning. And then if you ask, well, what's spinning the sun? And you'd be told it's conserved from the galactic spin. And then if you ask, well, what's spinning the galaxy? Then you'd be told, well, you know, the cluster and the supercluster, and eventually you'd get back to the Big Bang. And that doesn't really tell you where spin came from.
And does every object out there spin?
It seems to be,
yeah. Isn't that weird all by itself? Every star, every planet, everything spins.
That's right. And even the atoms that you're made of, and that's a lot of atoms, billions and billions of atoms, and they're all spinning very close to the speed of light. And that's really remarkable because they're spinning continuously for billions and billions and billions of years. And so for me, it was not adequate to say, well, it all started spinning in the Big Bang, and we're not going to tell you where the energy came from to do that. And it's been spinning ever since in a frictionless environment, because our environment is just not frictionless. There's all sorts of frictions in our universe, field interactions, plasma, and all this stuff. And so for me, I thought, no, there must be a source to the spin of everything. And I start to look at Einstein's equations of space-time, and I start to realize that torque and Coriolis effect had been removed from those equations. And I, with the help of Dr. Rauscher and Dr. Heisen, we've put spin or torque and Coriolis effect back into space-time to explain the origin of spin, the source of the spin of everything. Really, it really becomes the source of life because everything spins into existence. And so it's like, think of it of like almost like space-time as a fluid spinning. And when it makes little eddy currents, when it makes little vortices, we see it as an atom or a particle.
What would happen if nothing spun?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, that's the thing. It may be a frame of reference thing. If nothing spun, it might be because you're spinning with it. I believe actually that there is zero spin at singularity, that when you reach that infinite nature at the center of the atom, that's like the center of the eye of the hurricane, you know, where there's no wind.
Right, and it's calm.
Yeah, exactly. That's what centers our universe. That's what centers our galaxies. That centers our atoms and so on. That stillness.
So is there a stillness in our universe somewhere?
Yeah, at the center of all things.
You believe that, right in the middle?
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah, just like a hurricane, you know, or a tornado. And, you know, it's a dynamic between spin and stillness that produces the feedback structure that makes information continuously flow through our universe, and the system self-organized that way, but highly self-organized.
Okay, atoms are inanimate. They aren't alive, correct?
Right. Well, I mean, how you describe life.
They don't eat. They don't die. They're not rest. So here's my question.
Yes.
When an egg is fertilized and it turns into a baby, and the baby is born, okay? Are there more atoms in that body than when it first started? That's my first question.
Yes, absolutely, because there is duplication of cells and there is nutrients that are being agglomerated to produce the duplication of cells. So, you know, we all started with one cell, and interestingly, we go through a very similar evolution that, you know, the monocellular system went through on Earth through its evolution to become, you know, very complex multicellular system. We all went through that same evolution when we were, you know, conceived from one cell that doubled up and so on, and eventually to produce the 100 trillion cells of our body, which are made out of billions of atoms.
Okay, so but here's my question. If these atoms then that aren't alive, and I'm thinking of alive in our terms,
yes,
and we have, you know, zillions of them in a child that become a human being, a grown full-size human being, when that person passes on and becomes rubble and dust and decays, uh-huh, what happens to the rest of those atoms that were there in that human? You know, zillions of them, now the body's gone. Where are they?
Well, you know, that's an interesting concept, an interesting thing to think about, because when you think about it, you could say that you're shedding millions of cells every minute.
Right.
And each cell is made of a lot of atoms. So you're basically constantly shedding a trail of atoms throughout your life.
But they don't die, right?
The atoms don't die.
No, but so where do they go?
They continuously spin. They retain a state of relationship to other atoms in which they change phase. For instance, they, you know, may go back to the soil and become soil, or be digested by a worm, and, you know, they continuously, this is why I believe we live in this infinite feedback structure of creation, is that you can't actually find anything to disappear. You just see changes in the states of things. So all the atoms that you've always been made of, you know, all the way through your life, and all the atoms you will be made of when you die will still continue to do what they do, which is change state and recycle themselves, and they might end up in another human being not so far down the road.
Or in a soul.
Yeah. Well, you know, then the soul is, you know, is another subject. You know, you got to look at the atomic structure. As a self-organizing system, what would be the soul? Well, maybe the soul is the information that's gathered by such a system, the information that makes up you, you know, and that information is conserved as well. You can't, it most likely continues on, and there's no reason to think that it would not reorganize in another set of atoms at one point.
Do you think Einstein went through this same little perplexing thought mode?
I'm sure he did. When you read Einstein and when you study his life, I think Einstein was a great philosopher, a great thinker, and he was certainly not limited to the conventional views of physics, and that's what made him Einstein.
You know, getting back to your theory again of spin, as it's tied, let's say, to the creation of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to me, and I keep harping back at this, even though we're not talking about harp anymore. it just sounds like it was planned. it was designed. You know, I'm not trying to have you say you believe in God. I'm not asking you that at all.
Uh-huh.
But it just sounds like there's way too much intelligence behind this. Somebody or something knew what it was doing.
Yes. Well, that's what I believe, is that the universe knows what it's doing. This is why it's highly organized. You know, it's like there is this underlying self-organizing energy that connects all things, and that's why it's able, it knows where everything is, because every little proton of every little atom is connected to all other protons in all of the universe. And some of the math I just written in that Schwarzschild paper is, you know, proves that. And so this idea that everything is connected and that it's all in communication, you know, makes it possible for systems to self-organize. So when you're talking about the intelligence of the universe, you're really talking about the intelligence of you. You know, you're an extremely intelligent person, and I don't mean you just personally, but...
What? You mean I'm not?
No. But human beings, you know, or any biological entity, or, you know, or even maybe non-biological entity, there's an intelligence there. You're absolutely correct. And what I'm saying is that the intelligence is not an extra, you know, universal intelligence, like an overseeing intelligence. It's part of the system that makes up the universe itself. It's not separated from us. It's actually everything together is the intelligence.
Was it always there? Do you think it was even there before the Big Bang?
The Bang? Well, absolutely. I believe, you know, it was one of the hardest part in my study. It was to come to conclude that there was never a beginning and there would never be an end. There was never a chicken or an egg. It's always both, that there's continuous, infinite cycles. And in one way, it feels like when you're trying to visualize that, it feels like unsettling and, you know,
oh, it rattles your brain.
It does. But actually, when you concede to it, when you let go of an idea of a beginning and an end, which is really based on the frame of reference of a human being, you know, then all of a sudden there's a relaxation that you, oh, wow, there's this amazing continuous creation process that goes from infinitely back to infinitely forward, and I'm just part of this amazing will work of nature. It actually brings you to new levels of discoveries, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. What's new with your website?
Well, you know, I'm in the middle of revamping the website, so I'm you know, getting ready to change it, and we're starting all sorts of new programs as well. The programs that I had started, the Emissary program, is still going, but we're starting a shorter program, which is the Delegate program, where people can come and spend 3 days or 2.5 days with me over a weekend, and we can go into the details of the theory, because so many times in my talks, it's just too short for me to explain all of the details of the series. So a lot of people have been requesting that. So it's very exciting. We already had one Delegate program. It was very popular, and it was a great weekend. And there's another one coming in May for the East Coast in New York, and probably one coming up for Europe as well.
All right, very good. Well, when we come back, we have to put consciousness into the equation. And how does that fit? We'll be back in a moment with physicist Nassim Haramein on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Okay, in a couple of weeks, keep your eyes open for the LA Times. They're doing a huge feature on Coast to Coast AM. So we'll let you know that exact date, as well as the ABC Nightline segment, which should air in a few weeks as well. As soon as we get that date, I'll let you know, and we'll also post it on the coasttocoastam.com website. Nassim, what is the role of consciousness in all of this?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, I mean, many physicists are looking at trying to find a relationship between consciousness and the material world. In my views, they're not so separate. I think that they actually are related very deeply, that what we call consciousness is actually, a feedback, is actually a sense of self, self-awareness, demands like a certain amount of information feedback in the system. So I think that it's inherent to the material world, that because of the way the material world actually works, consciousness is a part of it. It's permeating everything. It's part of everything. It's part of the structure of space itself. It's part of the way the material world comes to exist. And those are very, very deep philosophical questions.
Sure.
And I think that we're starting to get a glimmer on what that means, you know, to physics, and how the universe can self-organize in such amazing way as we see on our planet. And so I think there's a great horizon there for us.
Do you think that through consciousness that people can tap into each other, whether it's through telepathy or intuition?
Yes, all these phenomenons that have been reported by so many different people at different times, and not necessarily, you know, very unusual people like psychics and others, but you know, day-to-day, you know, normal people you see everywhere, having deja vu experiences and many different experiences that seem to, I mean, they're taught as psi experiences, they seem to show that there is a direct link between systems. And this is what I was talking about, is that every point is connected to every other point in our universe. So it makes sense that if we understand that information is available from any point to any other point. So in some sense, in certain circumstances, people could have experiences where they can telepathically connect with another person or some strange event where, you think of a person and they call you, there's all sorts of events that occur in everyday life that have to do with this interconnectivity that's already present from the atomic level up, and that actually those woo-woo effects are not so woo-woo. They're actually part of the physics of creation.
For people who have this ability to tap into this, and it takes training, but what do you think allows them to do it? Well, how does it work?
I think that it's actually available to most people. It's a question, as you said, of training and taking the time to actually experience the space around you, to experience the structure of creation around you, to tap into the field. I mean, so many of these people talk about tapping into the field, and I think when they talk about that, they're talking about this fundamental energy source that's at the source of the creation of everything, that is in the space, and it holds all the information that coordinates all the atoms in the universe. And if you take the time, and I believe that this is why so many masters that have walked the earth talked about meditation and prayer and many different modalities, yoga and so on, to take the time to connect with this fundamental force at the source of creation. When you do that, then you start to what I call being a vacuum engineer. You start to connect with this force. You start to understand how it works, how it flows. Some of the Eastern tradition may call it Chi Master. Others call it, the Tao, and so on. And that when you start to connect with that fundamental energy, you can manipulate it. You can manipulate it to produce benefit in health of other people. You can manipulate it to communicate with other people, and so on, in a non-linear way, in a way that is not commonly done.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go now. Let's go to Jill in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Jill. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I am enjoying your show so much as I do every night.
Thank
I would
you.
Enjoy it more if we're here in Chicago. We could get the last 2 hours like we used to. But anyhow, I wanted to ask your guest what he feels or what he thinks and feels about the discrimination that I hear going on between the mainstream science community and the theory of intelligent design.
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, there's been, you know, discrimination between the mainstream scientific community and many theories throughout the years. But, you know, there is, it's all I can say about that is that in general, it's very difficult for people to accept ideas that, you know, that there's some creative force that's not, you know, completely materialistic in nature. And I think that the difficulty there is that actually there's a middle ground between the completely materialistic view and the more religious view, that actually, you know, it's a blend of the two, really. That's in one way what I'm talking about, although I believe that that energy that's self-organized can be reasoned, can be, you know, described in appropriate mathematics and appropriate physics, which does not make it non-divine in any case. It just shows that there's fundamental mechanics that this energy uses to produce creation that can be described in appropriate physics and mathematics. And so I think that there's a middle ground between those two opposite views, and I wish more people would look for that middle ground. And I think the key is that feedback between the material world and the vacuum structure. I believe that the intelligent design people are thinking about this all prevailing godlike power, and that the material people, the standard model, is thinking of the material world, and I think it's both.
Tell me a little bit more about your work with this geometric array that you believe is fundamental to creation.
Well, when you study the structure of the vacuum, when you study how the space would self-organize all of our material world, you come to conclude that there must be some fundamental geometric parameter that it's following to self-organize. Like some kind of geometry of that fractal nature must occur, like a fundamental, you know, pattern that nature follows. And then when you look at nature all around you, you find that pattern everywhere, meaning like you look at a flower, you look at a tree, you look at a human being, or you know, all of the natural world, and you see patterns everywhere, and they repeat themselves in very constant mathematical function, meaning like, for instance, you find the phi ratio 1.618 everywhere, the Fibonacci series everywhere, and so on. So then you must come to conclude that this self-organizing energy has this fundamental geometric pattern. And when you combine that with knowledge that was left by ancient civilization all around the world that seemed to point to very specific geometric structure, and advanced physics that seemed to show that this, you know, some fundamental geometry at the source of creation, then, you know, it starts to come together. And as I did that, I came to very specific geometries, very specific conclusions about these geometries, and the possibility of understanding this fractal structure and applying it to technology to transform our world.
Let's go to San Diego. Greg, you're up, and you're a first-time caller. Hi, Greg.
Yeah, Nassim is he's blowing my mind. I've studied his work. I think he's the next Einstein.
Great.
Thank you.
I want to know about, I know how you compare everything to atoms, and an atom has a structure of a nucleus and then space and then the electrons around it. And then I started to get into the hollow earth theory, and it seems to make sense. What do you think about that?
Oh, good.
And if you do believe in it, does it apply to all the planets, all the celestial bodies in the universe?
Yes, very good question. You know how I was describing the center of hurricanes as the point of stillness, you know? And the center of the hurricane is not only the point of stillness, but it's the point where, you know, there is not so much material. The density is much lower. And so my the analogy stands for what you were describing. If this is all correct, if singularity is at the center of everything, if everything is connected in that way, then the vacuum, yes, space is present at the center of all things, and it's present in different scales at different level, meaning that, you know, the singularity at the center of our Earth would have pull much of the matter around itself, into itself, and, you know, leave a space there. So it is very possible that the center of the Earth has a hollow core, and there is new geological evidence that that's correct. There's many new studies that are showing that there may be an empty space in the middle of our Earth, you know, and it would apply to all the planets and the sun and the galaxies and so on.
Okay, we've got Gary now in San Diego on Coast to Coast. Hey, Gary, thanks for calling.
Hey, I'm glad to talk to you guys. I want to ask about matter, but first I'd like to say that our DNA has been proposed as a length that can be wrapped around the world. If that has ever been proven and attempted, most of us will never know or be able to prove such an event. All of us who are alive right now and expect to see an enlightened world can only achieve such an understanding through telepathy and not through spoken word. Depending on the primitive act of speaking through our mouth and not through our mind is what makes our progress slow. That being said, I would like to know that some people say that matter cannot be created or destroyed. What do you believe in that, and the fact that we aren't born at 150 pounds or so, we're born only at a few pounds? As we grow, matter seems to be created. Doesn't that mean that matter expands?
Well, so in your example, you know, actually that was an earlier question as well from George. I think that, you know, certainly in a human being, we certainly don't start at 150 pounds because that would be a problem for our mothers. But the material world that's accumulating to make a human being is actually being extracted from nutrients in the environment. It's not the atoms are not literally just appearing out of nowhere, meaning like your mother is eating food and there's all sorts of nutrients that are coming in. There's all sorts of atoms. There's all sorts of transformation that are occurring in the molecular structure that is agglomerating. And what's remarkable, this is what I'm addressing, what's remarkable is that it's agglomerating in a very precise, very organized way, which is a thing. It's a problem that's not really addressed in our biology or in our physics, and it keeps doing the same thing very precisely, very accurately for most people in the world, but that's not really matter creation. If you're asking me about matter creation, I would say yes. I believe that matter is constantly being created. The bang is constantly happening at the center of galaxies, at the center of suns, and maybe even at the center of planets, and that might be why planets continuously grow, as I believe. I believe that, you know, the physics of this continuous creation process is going to free us from the idea that there was just a big bang, and it's just in a random way we, by an incredible amount of luck and what is called in physics mathematical fluctuation, we happen to come together and be so well suited for the experience. And so what I'm saying is that, yes, I believe there is matter creation continuously going on. Our universe is a continuous creation system.
Tell me about the award that you got in Europe for your work on the Schwarzschild proton.
Well, this is a paper that was, that was presented to a scientific community conference in Belgium at the University of Belgium, and it's in the proceedings of this conference and is currently under peer review and getting ready to be published. And when I went to the conference, there's a certain amount of awards that are given for each field of physics or other fields of science that are present there at the conference. And my paper won the Best Paper Award for relativistic and quantum theory and field theory and so on. And so it was a great honor for me. I was quite surprised because the paper is quite radical. The paper describes atoms as mini black holes. It it describes them in terms of semi-classical physics that would be, Einstein's equations and mechanical equations instead of using quantum theory. And it gets the right answers for the energy of the nuclei and its dynamics and so on, its measured values in laboratories. So it gives the right answer. It unifies the fields because it uses Einstein field equation instead of quantum theory. And it's quite disturbing to the standard model. So I was very surprised to receive an award. I was very glad, though.
How many people are working on that? On the same kind of theories? Are you out there all by yourself?
Well, I've been out there by myself for a long time.
Yes, you have.
Yes, but
sometimes with a noose around you, right?
That's right. It's it can get pretty hairy out there. I think that more and more people are warming up to the idea. I mean, think about it, George. When you think of an atom continuously spinning, with an electron going at near the speed of light, I mean, it starts to look more and more like a mini black hole, a very energetic, singularity. And I think that actually is the correct answer. Now, whether or not we can write the physics to describe it appropriately, I think is the crux. And it's taken us a very long time to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. Well, stay with us. When we come back at the top of the hour, full hour of phone calls left for Nassim Haramain. And then in the last hour of the program, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment as well. And I invite you all to go to Nassim's website, which is the renaissanceproject.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch dial. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM.